You can take all those recovery shapes that people have been talking about, the V and the L and the W and the K, you can take them and, well, you know what you can do with them. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, today, the 14th day of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Opening, not opening. School, no school. Virus, lots of virus. We were batting ideas around at our news meeting this morning. What the what with this economy, given where we were like a month ago and where we are now. And we were going around and around, as I said. And finally, we looked over at Mitchell Hartman. I mean, as much as you can actually look at somebody on Zoom. And we said, Mitchell, go make some calls, would you?
There are a couple indicators showing the reopening recovery has stalled out. Analyst Nick Shields at Third Bridge follows retail foot traffic. It picked up in May, but now the resurgence of COVID-19 in the South and West is taking a toll.
Since late June, you know, the biggest drop-offs are happening in Mississippi, Texas, South Carolina, Louisiana, and Alabama.
Same story with jobs. Postings at the employment site Glassdoor are down 6% since the end of June. So what kind of recovery does all this leave us with? Camilla Yanishevsky tracks the consumer economy at CFRA Research.
We're going to be seeing a W-shaped recovery.
Down sharply, turning up a bit, then turning down again for the second half of the W. Yanishevsky says that's probably where we are now.
These reclosings, they're driving consumers to be even more anxious about potential exposure. It's this fear that's the biggest roadblock to any near-term sustainable improvement.
All this fits with what independent florist Brooke Wetzel is seeing in her business. I caught up with her at the giant wholesale flower market in downtown LA, which she says is operating sort of normally.
Yeah, normal with mandatory face masks.
Wetzel shut down in March, started up again a couple months later. She says folks still want to send flowers.
People are still at home, and they can't visit each other when they would have for a special occasion. Babies are still being born. I mean, unfortunately, people are still passing away. Everybody's still having birthdays.
Her business has been pretty good. But looking around the flower market,
I would say about three quarters of the vendors are back. Not everybody came back. They're gone for good.
And with California closing businesses again, Wetzel hopes people don't stop splurging on flowers. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
We mentioned on the program yesterday the oh-so-very-strange earnings season we have entered on. There is so much uncertainty out there. Banks are on tap this week. J.P. Morgan announced this morning record revenue, almost $4.7 billion in profit. However, the bank is also setting aside $10 billion in bad loan reserves. And it ain't just JPM. Wells Fargo and Citigroup did the same, suggesting, as Mitchell pointed out a minute ago,
they've all come to the same conclusion that the economic recovery is going to take much longer than we had originally hoped.
That's Jared Harford at the University of Washington. Banks, he says, know whereof they speak.
Banks have daily interactions with, you know, hundreds of thousands of borrowers, and they've got their own economist. And so this is basically aggregating up what they're seeing from the street all the way up.
So not a V-shaped recovery then?
But then the second thing you want to get out of it is that they are setting aside large reserves now, because we don't want a repeat of the global financial crisis where, you know, we're caught flat-footed and we had issues of financial system stability.
And to that point, J.P. Morgan CEO Jamie Dimon said today, and this is a quote, "This is not a normal recession. The recessionary part of this, you're going to see down the road." So we've got that to look forward to. All right, moving on. You got to figure that between the shutdowns and the social distancing and the economic crisis that is making people not really excited to spend money they maybe don't have to right now, you got to figure, given all that, second, maybe only to airlines, the restaurant industry is among the biggest losers in this economy right now. And thus, a not unreasonable question. How many restaurants are we going to lose forever? Marketplace's Jasmine Garst has that one.
Lin Ta owns two restaurants in Los Angeles. One is in Koreatown, where her favorite dish is the frog legs. Her other outlet, she says, has got a mean catfish sandwich. Early on in the pandemic, she had to transition to takeout and delivery, but
we just didn't make any money. So there were nights where two orders would come in. There were nights where no orders came in.
Ta took out a PPP loan. Still, she says paying rent became a big concern. Restaurants nationwide have seen their income decimated by the shutdowns. Cornell University professor Alex Suskind predicts that 30% of restaurants may go out of business.
Restaurants historically are very cash flow dependent. And when you cut that off, restaurants that don't have any reserves or very low levels of reserves, it's a huge issue for them.
The NYC Hospitality Alliance recently found 80% of the city's restaurants did not pay full rent in June. Andrew Ridgey is the executive director of the alliance.
I think the federal government needs to come in with direct cash injections. We need to deal with the rent issue.
Back in L.A., Ta decided to close her Koreatown restaurant for now. The landlord for that spot has forgiven her rent for the time being. Her other restaurant is still open for delivery and takeout. She says her landlord won't renegotiate that rent. She's had to lay off 60 people. And she still can't break even on the amount of business she's getting.
There's just not enough. So what are we going to do? We're going to wait until we get kicked out, I guess.
She doesn't want to close down, but she's running out of ideas. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
Wall Street today, look, number one, not the economy. I've said that before. Number two, somehow traders think things are getting better. Why? Couldn't tell you. Details, numbers, you know the drill. We have been telling you low these past 2 years now about the Trump administration going after the Chinese telecommunications conglomerate Huawei, that it's a security threat, that it can't be trusted in cell phone networks, that it is just a bad actor, the White House says. Well, today, Washington got a big win. The British government says phone companies over there cannot buy Huawei equipment and they have to uninstall gear they have already got in place. This is quite the turnaround. And as Marketplace's Scott Tong reports, there are a couple of things going on.
2 months ago, the Trump administration began a campaign to kneecap Huawei's supply chain. It banned certain chipmakers from selling semiconductors to Huawei. In today's decision, the British government said the U.S. ban endangers Huawei's ability to build a sophisticated 5G network. Sam Visner directs cybersecurity for the MITRE Corporation, a research group.
It will be increasingly difficult to sustain a 5G network if it's built out of hardware that no longer has access to the most advanced technology.
But there's all kinds of geopolitics at work, too. At the University of Buckingham, International Studies professor Anthony Glee says Chinese aggression in places like Hong Kong has turned off the British government, as Washington has pressured London to abandon Huawei.
You could say this has been sabotaged. Huawei 5G has been sabotaged by President Trump.
By many accounts, Huawei's gear is cheaper and more advanced than its global competition. Still, the UK ban could pressure other European governments to follow, says telecom analyst Roger Entner at Recon Analytics.
It certainly makes the case much stronger for lawmakers that want to prevent Huawei in Germany, in France, in Italy.
Huawei is nonetheless making big inroads in the developing world, including Africa. So the way things are going, the wireless world could split into two technology halves. Paul Triolo heads geotechnology at the Eurasia Group.
There's going to be a world where Chinese companies are going to be able to compete and a world where they're going to have much more difficulty.
For its part, Huawei warned that banning it in the UK could backfire and, quote, move Britain into the digital slow lane. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
The killing of George Floyd and Michael Brown and Elijah McClain and Breonna Taylor and Eric Garner and many more black people by police were traumatic for a lot of people, most particularly black people in this country. Some of them want and need mental health care, and they are looking for therapists who can relate. Lisa Roth covers mental health for APM.
The COVID crisis almost spelled the closing of Anissa Keyes's business. Then a police officer killed George Floyd, and suddenly, as a Black therapist, she can hardly keep up with demand. Keyes recently got a call from a potential new client who said,
I need to be seen. My husband needs to be seen. We need couples work, and then my son needs to be seen. We need it to be an African-American therapist. And I'm just curious, by the way, is this an African-American ran agency? And if it's an African-American ran agency, are you also Black-owned?
Keyes can answer yes to all those questions. She runs a mental health clinic in North Minneapolis where Black clients make up the majority of her business. About half of the 16 therapists she employs are Black. More than half of the caseworkers are too. That's especially rare here. In Minnesota, Black mental health workers account for just over 2% of the profession, and nationally, the numbers are not much better. Keyes says before Floyd died, that didn't seem to matter so much. Clients rarely asked to see a Black therapist specifically. Now, though, she says pretty much all of them do.
This feels more so like, where can I feel safe? The nation has showed me that as a Black person in this country, I'm not safe. And so I think the feeling of going into a therapy office with a white-bodied person might not really feel safe.
And people need to feel safe for therapy to be effective. That's especially true now that most sessions have gone either online or to the phone to keep people safe from COVID-19. The anxiety police killings cause can last. One recent study looked at the mental health of people before and after police killings in the same state. It found that the resulting trauma affects Black communities for months afterwards. Marley Dorsey runs a practice focusing on racial trauma. She's part of the small community of Black therapists in Minnesota.
When they see the videos, they think about their own experiences with the police, which has not been very positive. Or their friends' experience with the police, which have not been very positive. Or their parents or their grandparents.
She says calls to her practice tripled the week after Floyd's death, because this isn't an isolated experience. Anissa Keyes says a lot of the calls she's been getting since Floyd died are from people seeking professional mental health care for the first time. And she doesn't want to have to turn anyone away. So she's been trying to hire more Black clinicians. She says she's having a hard time finding any. In the Twin Cities, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Somebody made the suggestion that I could sell shark's teeth in order to make a living, and I decided to give it a try.
I mean, why not, right? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 556 today, 2.1%, 26,642. The NASDAQ, 97 points to the good, 0.9%, 10,488. The S&P 500 up 42 points, about 1.3%, 31.97. As we talked about up at the top, banks are reporting this week. JPMorgan Chase added 0.5%. Bank of America gave back 0.2% today. Here's a note on our personal economy with a look at rent, specifically how many people are able to pay rent during this difficult economy. The National Multifamily Housing Council reports more than 77% of apartment households made a full or partial rent payment by July the 6th. That is down from 80% last month. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 0.62%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I'm going to set up this next interview with two reminders. Number one, that people are still out in the streets of this country pretty much every day protesting the way Black people have been treated by police and by society and in this economy. And number two, that what you wear when you're out there says something about what you mean to say. Tanisha Ford is a professor of history at the City University of New York. She has spent a good part of her career studying the intersection of those two things, social movements and clothing. Her 2015 book on the subject is called Liberated Threads, Black Women, Style, and the Global Politics of Soul. Professor, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
Do me a favor, would you, and give me some examples from history of fashion and protest movements and how they've kind of aligned.
A few highlights to me in thinking of clothing as a tool of resistance. I think of the suffragettes and their sashes and their use of white dresses, the Black Panther Party and their wearing of the black leather jacket and black berets. I think of ACT UP and their silence equals death t-shirts. And also, more recent examples include the hoodies and Asada Taught Me t-shirts that Black Lives Matter activists have worn, and even those very bright and iconic pink pussy hats of the Women's March, very recent.
I said fashion and you said clothing. Is there a difference in your mind as it comes to protest movements?
To me, there is a difference, because I think that most often activists, when they think about a symbol for their collective politics, they think of something that's already a part of the everyday wardrobe of that group. For example, if we use that hoodies example again, those hoodies were things that were part of the hip-hop culture, hip-hop ethos of style. And so when activists are wearing them, they're not necessarily wearing them as a fashion statement. They're wearing them as a symbol that represents very organically the group of people who are mobilizing against something like police brutality. So what happens oftentimes, though, is that corporations, fashion brands, they take those things and then elevate them to fashion, if you will, right? So they make it so that the everyday person wants to buy a hoodie, you know, a black hoodie with white writing or lettering on it.
Right. I was struck by the adaptability and utility of clothing in a protest movement, and specifically back in the civil rights movement, where the order of the day, clothing-wise, early on, was suits and ties. Look prim and proper and present yourself well. And then later changed to, as the activists and the movement became younger, changed to overalls and shirts. Talk about that for a minute, would you?
You know, that was one of my greatest finds when I was working on my first book, Liberated Threads. I started to look around and see some of the digital archives from the civil rights movement. And one of the things I noticed was that there were these young activists who were part of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, and they were wearing denim overalls. And what I learned after interviewing several of those people and also reading the FBI files on some of those prominent activists was that they were wearing those overalls to align themselves with the Southern sharecroppers they were organizing alongside of in places like rural Mississippi and rural Alabama. So they were wearing those things to reject the respectability politics of the national NAACP, which, of course, as you mentioned, you know, kind of becomes representative of this upstanding Sunday's best attire. But they were using those things to say, okay, as young college folks, we want to have a particular kind of class consciousness as part and parcel to our political platform, and the denim overalls became part of that.
All right, so let me throw a history professor question at the history professor. Compare and contrast that with what we see. Look, I was a history major. I love this kind of stuff. compare and contrast that with what we see today, where everybody's out there. There's no uniform, and yet there is some uniformity.
Right. You know, I think that the Ferguson moment was really powerful in that those activists kind of set an attire that activists today in 2020 are still wearing. I can think of people like Tef Poe saying that, listen, we're not going to be ashamed of our tattoos, of our, you know, our ball caps, of our t-shirts, that this is part of it for us. And so what we see now with protesters on the street today, you still see those message t-shirts, box braids in colors that are bright red and vibrant orange. I mean, all of that is a part of it. And I really love to see it. It also speaks to the queerness of this movement, that, you know, these movements were sparked by not only young black people, but young black queer people. And so we see a queer style aesthetic become central to Black Lives Matter organizing in ways that we hadn't seen in the previous generation, especially not in ways that made it into the more mainstream archiving of those movements.
Mm-hmm. Imagine yourself a history professor, which you certainly will be 25 years from now still, one hopes. As you look back on this moment, what's going to stand out to you?
You know, for me, it's these masks. It's the COVID-19 masks. You know, people are wearing masks to protect from infection. So the masks then become a different kind of armor, right? So on the one hand, we want to get across a message to the police, stop killing us. But in order to take that kind of collective stand, we have to go out and be on the front lines of a protest in the midst of a global pandemic. And that to me is representative of what it's like to be Black in this country, to always be choosing from a set of possibilities that are unfavorable. I encourage people, though, to exercise their right to protest, but gosh, I just really hate to see us have to do it under these conditions in which we know this virus is so infectious and so contagious.
Tanisha Ford is a professor of history at the Graduate Center at CUNY. Couple of books that you might want to check out. The first is Liberated Threads, about women in the politics of protest. Also, her memoir, Dressed in Dreams. Professor Ford, thanks for your time, ma'am. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Sometimes, if you're lucky, a hobby can turn into a job. For this latest installment of our series, My Economy, a story of how hunting for really old things became a lifeline, too.
My name is Skylar Angelot, and I am the co-owner of Palmetto Fossil Excursions here in the Somerville area of South Carolina. I got into fossil hunting because of my mom. My mom actually had me strapped onto her chest in a sling, walking down the beach looking for shark's teeth when I was a kid. And then as I got older, my cousins took me to free diving in the river. From there, I learned the art of digging layer. Last year, I left out of an abusive relationship. And I was a single mom as a full-time college student with an almost 4.0 GPA. And also taking care of my dad who had stage 5 Parkinson's. So somebody made the suggestion that I could sell shark's teeth in order to make a living. And I decided to give it a try. And then as I got better and better and better at finding megalodon teeth, somebody was like, you need to start doing tours. At first, I was really put off by the idea. I wasn't really into sharing that, you know, space with anybody. But then we pretty much became slam booked for the next month. And we've already got appointments booked as far out as December. We typically don't do tours for people that are from here unless we've done some extensive like background research into who they are as a person, mainly because there's a lot of local competition among hunters. And we don't want to see our sites get ruined because of other people coming back and basically pillaging the area. I love the history of life on Earth. I'm not a big fan of the history of mankind because it has a way of repeating itself. It's always about greed and battle and greed and battle and greed and battle. And for me, just studying nature the way that it is, the way that everything coexists so perfectly in a balance, and yet it's always changing, but there's never any turmoil within that changing system. I love studying that. And so fossils to me are just a reminder of the fact that this Earth has been constantly evolving and changing over millions and millions and millions and millions of years, actually 4.6 billion years to be exact. And even though it gets more and more complex as time goes on, everything here seems to find a way to survive.
Skylar Angelot is the co-owner of Palmetto Fossil Excursions down in Somerville, South Carolina. Tell us, would you, what you are digging around for in your own economy? Marketplace.org is where you do that. This final note on the way out today, in which the Trump administration has changed its mind. You remember a week or so ago, kind of out of nowhere, Immigration and Customs Enforcement said international students, graduate and under, whose schools had gone fully online for the fall, would effectively have to leave the country. Remember that? Well, today, just before one of the 8 lawsuits against the government was set to get going, a deal was announced. The new policy was suspended. And I'm going to say it again. Immigration policy is labor and economic policy. Okay, we're going. But here is your moment of economic context for this Tuesday. Inflation is back. Kinda. Consumer prices rose 0.6% last month, the biggest gain since 2012. Gas is what did it, also food prices. If, however, you are a regular listener to this program, you know you ought to look for core CPI, which takes out those volatile food and energy prices, and presto changeo, core consumer price index up just 0.2%. Our digital and on-demand team includes Ufuk Mehmetoglu, Olga Oxman, Beth Perlman, Erica Phillips, Brian Ronahan, and Tony Wagner. Tarn Yeves is our executive director of On Demand, and I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.